All right, counsel. The second case, series of cases that are submitted for oral argument today, styled generally as Henry Syngenta. We have a structure of oral argument that I believe counsel has both agreed to and submitted to the court, and that has the Kansas set of appeals going first. And so, counsel, would you make your appearance? And let's proceed with that. And as I noted, as a housekeeping matter, we're planning on taking a 10-minute break after the Kansas set of appeals, and then we'll come back and take up the rest of it.
May it please the court. Good morning, your honors. I'm Eric Allen Isaacson for the Kansas appellants, the Toops Kaufman plaintiff's attorneys and plaintiff's counsel, and Hosley Embry. This is a very important case, a very large case with a $1.5 billion settlement, $503 million attorney's fee award, which gets divided up among a lot of people, but in a very standardless and unfair fashion. It's an important case because it needs to establish sound rules for governing fee awards in hybrid mass action and class action litigation, where the settlement of both a class action and thousands of individual actions together needs to be done in a way that the attorneys get paid according to objective standards. Now, in this case, that just did not happen. The district court cited the Johnson factors to justify giving a third of the $1.5 billion fund as attorney's fees, but it didn't return to the Johnson factors when it came time to allocate the fees among the four funds. It didn't recite the Johnson factors when it came to allocating the attorney's fees within those funds. Indeed, the Illinois appellants will be arguing later, object to the fact that the Illinois pool was allocated without regard to the Johnson factors, and there was no Johnson factor analysis. Now, I have to acknowledge that the Supreme Court has said in the Purdue case, Purdue versus Kenny A. Axwell Wynn, that it thinks the Johnson factors are too subjective to permit meaningful appellate review, that they prevent an impressionistic award of attorney's fees, and that it's therefore better to go to the objective standard of a lodestar. Here, the attorney's fees could have been done in a way that would have looked at objective standards. A couple of them, one would be the lodestar. It's Johnson factor number one, the time and labor involved in the case. And another one would be the fee agreements that the individually represented plaintiff's counsel had with their clients for reasonable attorney's fees. Now, with respect to Hosley Embry and Toops Kaufman, those fee agreements range between 30 and 38%. The Watts-Guerra law firm, which represented a lot of appellants or a lot of individual corn producers as well, had fee agreements at 40%. And they put in a report from a number of very distinguished law professors, Arthur Miller, Charles Silver, Ryan Fitzpatrick, Alexandra Lahav, explaining that a 40% attorney's fee award for the individual actions was the market rate and a presumptively reasonable rate.
You arguing, Mr. Isaacson, that the that Judge Lundstrom should have enforced the contingency fee agreements? That's not an issue, right? Because, you know, Judge Lundstrom attributed one-third of the $1.51 billion to attorney fees, so nobody is seeking to enforce the contingency fee agreements, right?
No, we're not trying to enforce the contingency fee agreements against the clients. The question is, in awarding attorney's fees, was it reasonable to throw out the terms of those contingency agreements and disregard them, denying the lawyers the compensation they would have received under them?
So in other words, your position is that it would be appropriate, and you're not questioning Judge Lundstrom's decision not to treat those as dispositive, but that they should be entitled to greater than zero weight. Is that, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but is that your argument?
I think they're entitled to great weight. You look at the Third Circuit Dunn opinion that this court applied in Sears, and both this court and Don said that a court should be loath to throw out the contingency percentages that are agreed to by counsel. You know, it's going to be a very, very high burden to throw that out.
The cases are very fact specific, aren't they? I mean, in those cases, there was a lot more work done by the attorneys who had the contingent fee agreements than what Judge Lundstrom found here.
Well, in this case, you know, my clients put thousands of hours into representing their clients. If you look at the record in Joint Appendix at page 01238, you'll see that the Mitch Toop's law firm put 20,000 hours into the case, and Richard Kaufman's law firm put 13,000 hours into the case. Now, they had 9,000 clients. You want to divide those 33,000 total hours by 9,000 clients, you've got less than 4 hours apiece. That is a reasonable amount of work when you consider the necessity of explaining the case to the client, of having the client understand their options, and of continuing to communicate with the client. That's something that the lawyers have a duty to do, an ethical duty, quite frankly, to keep the client adequately informed of the litigation. And when you are putting pressure on the case to settle by having thousands and thousands of individual clients who can opt out and prosecute individual actions, and indeed have opted out in many instances in order to be able to prosecute the individual actions, you can't just write off that time. That's necessary time. Judge Lundstrom found that it was important time that, I mean, Judge Lundstrom found that it was very important that there were thousands of individual cases. And without that time, there would not have been those thousands of individual cases.
But when it comes time to allocate those three common benefit pools for the three states, here's my question. Is it's one thing to say, okay, there is a massive threat to Syngenta, say from Minnesota, because you have these thousands of lawsuits. But then when you come and it comes time to do the second phase of the analysis, say within Minnesota, within Kansas, within Illinois, and dividing up that piece of the pie, it seems to me that the problem that you're identifying, that the cause of the problem is that contingency fees and many of the Johnson factors are antithetical to the whole notion of allocating a common benefit pool. Because one of the problems that existed in Minnesota, for example, is that you have hundreds of law firms that are litigating a very important threat to Syngenta that you just pointed out, these mass lawsuits, but that they are very labor intensive, particularly when you compare the efficiency to an MDL, for example. So when you're dividing up between those hundreds of law firms fighting for that piece of that Minnesota pie, of course there's going to be inequities. Of course people aren't going to be treated just the same as they would in Kansas or Illinois, because there are so many more lawyers fighting because that they had chosen to litigate appropriately in a very labor inefficient way through these mass lawsuits.
Well, Your Honor, my clients were put in the Kansas allocation, not the Minnesota allocation.
Same point though. I'm just saying that the same problem exists in Kansas, because for example, you had Toots Kaufman, for example, were litigating individual cases. They weren't litigating the MDL or any of the class actions. So they were spending these thousands of hours in a very inefficient way. That's my point.
No, I don't think that was a very inefficient way, Your Honor, when you recognize the fact that having the individual actions is an important part of the pressure that was put on Syngenta. Magistrate Reisman found, Special Master Reisman found that it was an important factor in affecting the settlement. Judge Lundstrom found it was an important factor and increased the allocation to the IRPA pool to 12% to reflect that. That wasn't nearly enough, because if that's an important factor, you need to pay the lawyers at least their lodestar. You can't write off, you know, the vast majority of their time by putting them in the IRPA pool. The appellees suggest...
Isn't the whole premise of a percentage of fund construct the notion that yes, lodestar is one factor, but it is not the driving force for how one determines the reasonableness of the fees that counsel are going to get. I mean, if you spend a lot of hours, that doesn't mean that those hours correlate to a contribution to the result, the settlement. And so those two things aren't necessarily the same. And in fact, our case law recognizes, in fact, that the lodestar in this percentage of funds situation diminishes in its significance, doesn't it?
Well, that might apply to the allocation of one third of the $1.5 billion as attorney's fees, one third of the fund, 33%. The court went through Johnson factors analysis to do that. Once you're allocating the fees among lawyers who produced the result, the lawyers who contributed to the result, you need to pay them a reasonable fee, which is going to be either the contingency fee agreement that they entered, without which there would not have been the individual actions putting the pressure on Syngenta, or else their lodestar, because that's the attorney's reasonable hourly rate multiplied by the hours that were reasonably worked.
And well, Kansas still got the largest chunk of the pie, didn't it, of that money that was allocated, that third?
My complaint isn't that Kansas got too little money. My complaint is that people in the Kansas pool used the lodestar of Toops Kaufman and Hosley Embry to get a third of the $1.5 billion allocated as attorney's fees, used the fact that they were going to be compensating Hosley Embry and Toops Kaufman as a factor to say, you need to give us almost 50%. You need to give us 50%. And the court gave them 49% to the Kansas pool because they were going to be covering the allocations to lawyers like Toops Kaufman, who had thousands of clients in Illinois state court. And then they turn around and take the time and the hours that they've been talking about, and they give themselves the money at multipliers exceeding 3. And this court in Rosenbaum thought that a multiplier of 3.16 to 3.17 was shocking to the conscience. Here, the Kansas lead class counsel gave themselves multipliers exceeding 3, and they relegated Toops Kaufman and Hosley Embry to getting a tiny fraction. I mean, out of the Kansas pool, Toops Kaufman got less than 5% of their...
Go ahead, Judge McHugh.
Well, I take issue with some of your calculations of the various fractions and percentages. And one of the first of all, you don't include any common benefit work that you would have been able to collect from one of the other pools, from other than the individual pool. And I think you have to look at the total figure. And one of the problems I have is we don't know yet what the sum certain is for any of the attorneys in this case, because we don't know what the allocation is yet for the IRPA pool. I mean, so to some extent, I agree. We're looking at it not on the basis of what your contingent fee agreement is. It's a common fund case, so it's all relative of who did the most work to benefit the settlement, but I don't know how we compare the relative fairness of these awards without having a final decision on how much each firm got. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, I think that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. That was our position in the jurisdictional briefing. That continues to be our position at this point. I think that we need to know what the allocation from the IRPA pool is going to be rather than making guesstimates.
Well, that raises the issue of whether we have jurisdiction over these appeals, and that is a troubling issue. I mean, why is it in fact the case that if one takes the premise that this post-judgment litigation relating to attorney's fees is a separate sort of discrete litigation, then the principle, the construct that finality sets in when everything is resolved except for the district court essentially entering judgment, well, the IRPA pool distribution still needs to take place. You don't know how much you're going to get. And so why are these appeals final at all?
I don't think they are, Your Honor. We noticed, as an appellate lawyer, I don't take chances when it comes to finality. If there's a risk that someone might think an order is final, I notice an appeal. We noticed appeals from these orders thinking that there is some risk someone might think they're final, but we didn't think they are. We don't think that we're going to have a final appealable order, quite frankly, until there's a final IRPA pool order.
Well, if there's been a final IRPA pool order, then the question I need to ask you is, there's been a lot of ink spilled. There's been a lot of hours from talented counsel spent on this appeal, this appeal. My question to you is, if we're as we sit here now, we determine, whoa, we don't have appellate jurisdiction over this. What is our option? I mean, what do you propose that we do? I mean, one option, the draconian one, but it may be the necessary one, is to dismiss these appeals. And so tell me what, you know, tell me, Mr. Isaacson, what do we do if we're faced with that conclusion?
That would be that would be one option, to simply dismiss the appeals and start over again when the IRPA pool has been allocated. Another option would be to abate these appeals, recognizing that the IRPA pool is now in the final stages. The deadline for filing appeals from the initial proposed IRPA allocation was, I think, extended from February 24th to March 10th. So it's currently in the appeals process. I think there's likely to be a final order on the IRPA pool allocations in a matter of weeks.
And let me ask you on that, because I've given a little bit of thought to that, and I want to know, what authority do we have that you can give us to suggest that we can do that? And I mean, if we're in a situation where we were to determine that we don't have jurisdiction, do we have jurisdiction to put this thing on hold again and abate? I mean, what would be the basis for us to do that?
I think the basis for doing that would be that there is a contest regarding jurisdiction. There are arguments that are being made on both sides of whether there's jurisdiction or not. And knowing that there will be jurisdiction soon, the most efficient course may be to abate the appeals until the jurisdiction is present.
Sometimes federal courts do not operate on the principle of efficiency, as I'm sure you know. And beyond that, it would be efficient, but I guess what I'm struggling with, and frankly, given I know the amount of energy that's been expended on this case by everybody, I want a quick fix to this answer. But are you saying that we just don't look at the fact that we just accept, oh, this is a contested issue, and therefore we leave it alone and not explore it? I mean, it's presumably we've looked at this, we all have, and come to some at least provisional conclusion as to whether we have jurisdiction. Do we just ignore that and abate?
I think you've got the power to abate. I mean, the jurisdictional issue was presented to a motions panel, and the motions panel initially abated the appeals. And after the allocation of all of the common benefit pools had been accomplished, ordered the case to be briefed.
And they kicked it to the merits panel for a determination as to whether we have jurisdiction, which is, and I don't want to keep eating up your time on this issue, but it is one that I've given no short measure of thought to, and I'm just struggling to understand how do we do that? I mean, what does it look like? I mean, do we say this is a contested jurisdictional issue, we don't need to decide it now, we abate? Is that what you're proposing that it looks like?
I think that's an option. I think, you know, I've argued appeal, was involved in appeal before the Second Circuit, where the court concluded that there wasn't a sufficiently final judgment, and they basically sent it back to the district court, strongly suggesting that it might want to enter a 54B judgment. The district court entered the 54B judgment, and the case was decided on the basis of the briefs and the argument that had been made to that point. You might be able to do something like that here.
Well, we've done things of that sort, but I mean, number one, it's not our job to drive this litigation. Nobody asked for a 54B before the district court. I mean, that's not really our job. But I mean, we've been in a situation where we've given the district court an option to grant a 54B, but that was way before where we're sitting right now. You know, I mean, we're sitting here hearing these eloquent arguments, and we're way beyond, it seems to me, where we have traditionally referred it back to the district court to consider a 54B, right? So we're sitting on it. And I guess what I'm trying to, and I'm not trying to make light of this because I think it's a very significant issue. What I'm trying to understand is, given the posture that we're in now, you know, at this late stage in the game, are we still situated to back away from the jurisdictional issue and just say we're going to reimpose the abatement? Do you see any obstacle to us doing that?
I do not, as I sit here, see an obstacle to doing that. I mean, it's also quite possible that you would end up working on an opinion about why there's no jurisdiction. And in the course of working on that opinion, there'll be a final allocation of the IRPA pool. I don't know.
Then we'd have to have a new briefing because the merits briefs all have, all their arguments are based on assumptions about what's going to happen in the distribution from the IRPA pool, and that might change.
There would at least have to be supplemental briefing for certain. I see that I'm down to about 5 minutes. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may.
That's fine.
Good afternoon. Brad Wilders, representing the 56 firms in the Kansas leadership and presenting argument with respect to this appeal on behalf of all of the joint appellees.
Mr. Wilders, we have a wonderful question right before us now on jurisdiction. I think it would be a good thing to start there because I think that on your side, there was advocacy for lifting the abatement under the notion that the IRPA pool distribution would be essentially a ministerial act unrelated to the merits. Well, if everybody stands to get a cut, all of the appellants stand to get a cut, I assume you're on your side too, stand to get a cut from the IRPA pool, and there is no sum certain as to what the attorney's fees will be, and that IRPA pool, and I want more details on the IRPA pool allocation, but at least as I understand it, it involves objections that can be filed. So why is that a ministerial process, and why is it the case that we don't, that we have jurisdiction right now?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. So it is a ministerial process because all of the district court has laid out the formula for allocating the IRPA pool. There's $60.4 million. It will be allocated to everyone who made a timely IRPA allocation according to in proportion to the amount that their clients receive in relation to other IRPAs. The objection period is limited because what the special master is determining, and she'll make a report to Judge Lundstrom, she is determining which clients were retained by which lawyers according to the fee agreements that were submitted. So it's possible there could be a subsequent appeal of those issues, but that would be limited to, was this my client or was this someone else's client or did I have an appropriate fee agreement with that client? It would not cover the same issues, the discrete set of issues that are involved in this appeal, which is
let me pause right there. Okay, so there is a potential for litigation relative to whose client was belonged to what lawyer or what lawyer could claim what client and that sort of thing. Well, when there's a potential for litigation in a matter, one often does not perceive, and I'm talking about the discrete attorney's fees universe now, one doesn't often perceive finality, that to have the ring of finality, that's the first thing. Second thing is, isn't our case law talking about a sum certain as providing the basis for finality in attorney's fees litigation? Where are the sum certains here, since everybody hopes to get a little cut out of that IRPA pool?
Well, I think the sum certains are, there is a sum certain that have been reduced as to the three jurisdictional pools. There's no dispute on that. So what's left is the IRPA pool, and there's a formula there for that to be determined.
But aren't the lawyers in those pools, those three jurisdictional pools, aren't they getting money out of the IRPA pool?
The same firms could be, perhaps not all of them, but if they had individual clients and they made an IRPA allocation, they could be getting additional money out of that pool. Now, I would say that's not unheard of in these types of post-judgment proceedings. I know that we cited some cases in our jurisdictional briefing from the Second Circuit where there was going to be more fee allocations made or more fee awards made for post-settlement and post-judgment work, right? When you're getting a fee award over the course of time. At some point, you kind of have to look at it. And I think in the post-judgment proceedings, it's slightly more pragmatic than in the pre-judgment proceedings because you're trying to define what is the the universe that would make an appropriate appellate unit, right? And the appropriate appellate unit here, in our view, we've met that burden because the common benefit pools have been allocated. The court has decided how the IRPA pool is going to be allocated, and any subsequent appeals would be very limited to the discrete issue about the factual findings relative to was this firm entitled to a share for this particular client.
But part of it is, I'm sorry, were you going to say something, Judge Packer?
No, go ahead, Your Honor. Please,
you go ahead.
Isn't part of what's driving this train, though, for some of the clients on the merits front, fairness? I'm not treated fairly. At the end of the day, I don't get what I think I'll do. And if part of what the ultimate determination of fairness is going to be is what is the total that they're going to get, we can't say what the total they're going to get is until we know what their cut is from the IRPA pool, right?
Yeah, and so this was addressed at the district court level. It actually came up at the hearing on the special master's report and recommendation, and Judge Lundstrom asked her, why shouldn't we wait until the IRPA pool is allocated? And what she said at the hearing was, it would not change my recommendation as to how you'd allocate the fee, because the guiding principle for the fee determination here, or the allocation, was what was the relative contribution of each of the individual law firms and the jurisdictions. And that's not going to change based on how much, you know, the Toops Kaufman firm gets versus how much someone else gets, because the work that went into getting your IRPA allocation was simply whether your client submitted a claim form. That worked.
Okay, let me understand if I didn't mean to cut you off, but let me see if I understand you. You're saying that the special master said it wouldn't affect the determinations that she made relative to the pool, to the attorneys who were in the pools, to the allocations of the attorneys in the pools, right? What happens to the IRPA litigation? Well, I guess, yes, I get that, but that's not my point. My point is whether it affects the allocations in the attorneys pool, in the jurisdictional pools, doesn't go to the question of whether those attorneys in the jurisdictional pools can claim some level of unfairness by the total amount that they get relative to this attorney's fees litigation. That's the question. And why isn't that a question of jurisdictional import is what I'm trying to get at.
I guess two reasons. One, the amount that they're going to get individually doesn't change the relative contributions between them and other attorneys, which is what the district court decided.
Well, it might. I mean, we can't decide what's relative until we have all the totals to compare to one another.
Well, I guess I disagree on that point, in the sense that what the district court determined in terms of relativeness was what was the overall value that the individual lawsuits brought versus what was the overall value that the class actions and the substantive litigation brought to the table. And so I think that doesn't change based on the specific amounts that each firm has got. However, I would also point out that because the district court has set the IRPA formula and set the total IRPA amount, we are able to estimate, and we are able to show what the appellants are most likely to get from the IRPA pool if their clients all get an approved. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, how do you finish your sentence? Right.
We're able to estimate this because it is set by a formula, and whether they get more or less really depends on whether their clients were larger farmers or smaller farmers.
Exactly. And just to bring this discussion maybe to a practical debate, assuming that this is a ministerial function in terms of, you take the math, you take the pro rata portion, and there's another practical question, and that is it for practical purposes, in order to fully adjudicate Mr. Isaacson's argument, should we, even if there were final jurisdiction, a final order because of the ministerial nature of the distribution of the IRPA pool, should we, as a practical matter, abate the appeal anyway? Because your brief and Mr. Isaacson's really underscored what Judge McHugh is talking about. And that is, you said exactly what you just said. And that is, assuming, say, Toops, Kaufman, and Hosley's average IRPA client is an average size, and they're probably bigger because they, unlike, 52% of the of the farmers, you know, they're big enough to be able to afford Mr. Isaacson. And then Mr. Isaacson says, well, we may or may not get as much as Mr. Wilders has said in his brief. And what your comment underscores just now is, you know, that is a significant issue that might not have affected the special master's recommendation, but it seems that it will inevitably affect how we adjudicate Mr. Isaacson's argument. For example, that Hosley is only getting $6,000 and you're saying, no, Hosley is going to get a whole bunch more out of the IRPA pool. Well, Hosley may not be as competent as you.
Well, I don't know that the I doubt that the size of the farm is going to vary that much when you're talking about 9,000 clients. There's going to be an average. And remember, his share of the IRPA pool is going to be compared to everyone else who hired lawyers, not to the people who didn't. So the notion that the idea that has sometimes been raised that if you hired a lawyer, you were probably a bigger farmer, probably is not going to impact the IRPA pool. But I understand the point that you're making on the practical matter. Obviously, the amount that we've suggested they're likely to get, they haven't disputed. And if, you know, they would say that amount is too low. So if they get more than that, you know, we would be in the same place. I guess to try to tie this off, I do think to answer Judge Holmes' question to Mr. Isaacson, I do think you have the authority to abate this and wait to issue any judgment until the IRPA pool is decided, which, as Mr. Isaacson indicated, the initial objections are due today. The special master will then issue her report, and then Judge Lungstrom will either adopt it or modify it.
And did you find, and I looked, did you find a persuasive case that would support that premise?
Well, I had another case. My firm had another case called Garcia versus Tyson Foods that I apologize, I don't have the citation, but it was similar in that it was an appeal from a class settlement and judgment and fee award. But the allocation of the money to the class members, the plan of allocation had not been entered by the court. And we got to oral argument and we found controlling precedent by this court that was a jurisdictional problem for the appeal. And I believe what this court did was remand it after the oral argument or right before, remand it for a 54B or abate it until we had a final judgment.
That's
so
right.
I think it happens.
Well, I was on the panel.
And I think that's consistent with the general rule that when a court doesn't have jurisdiction, that precludes it from entering the judgment. So simply abating and not entering in a judgment is not something I believe that would be inappropriate when you know a final order is going to be coming soon. If I could, I would like to turn some to the merits here of the Kansas appellant's appeals. The appellants here do not and cannot meet the standard for reversal. The standard of review limits this court's inquiry to determining whether or not the district court acted within the bounds of permissible choice. It does not permit this court to independently assess the weighting of factors and what the individual fee awards were or to fine-tune fee awards. Rather, it is limited in that fashion. The district court here conducted what no one can dispute is the most deliberate and extensive fee allocation proceeding that anyone has ever identified. And he concluded that while the individual lawsuits brought some value to the litigation, that value was substantially outweighed by the class actions and the other work that was undertaken by the attorneys on the substantive pieces of the litigation. No one was better equipped than the special master who oversaw the settlement negotiations and the three trial judges who presided over this litigation for several years and over two trials in three jurisdictions to make these particular findings. This court has stated that a district court has, quote, intimate knowledge with regard to the value of the services rendered by attorneys in determining fee allocation proceedings or in determining fee awards. That was in Brown versus Phillips Petroleum. And none of the three legal theories that the appellants on this appeal raise withstand the scrutiny necessary for any type of reversal. First, with respect to their argument that the IRPA pool should have been bigger, the complaint that the district judge misvalued the mere existence of the individual cases is contrary to the findings and the record below. The clients of Mr. Isaacson's and the other IRPAs may have filed lawsuits for thousands of individuals, but those lawsuits were over 99% of those were stayed for the entire course of the litigation. And when substantive work was required, they were compensated separately from the jurisdictional pools for that work. Second, with respect to the argument regarding the Lodestar, the self-reported and almost entirely reconstructed Lodestar of the Kansas appellants consists of work the district court found did not actually advance the litigation. And that's a finding that he made specifically and is not challenged on appeal with any particular evidence. The Lodestar, this court has said in Brown versus Phillips Petroleum, a district court need not analyze a fee in a common fund setting based on the Lodestar when in its judgment, a reasonable fee is derived by giving greater weight to other factors.
Let me interrupt. Even if they don't, even if the district court didn't have to consider the Lodestar in a common fund allocation, it was required to consider the Johnson factors, correct?
The Johnson factors, I believe, is what the district court effectively considered. And
the argument, as I understand it from the Kansas appellees, is that while the court considered them at one stage to determine the overall size of the aggregate attorney's fee and even the allocation among pools, it didn't consider the Johnson factors with respect to individual allocations within the pools.
So I think that argument is incorrect. First, I would point out that this court has stated in reviewing fee awards in the Uselton case and the unpublished decision in Law versus NCAA that a district court need not tick through each Johnson factor. What's important is whether upon a review of the record, this court can decide that the district court considered the Johnson factors that matter. And not every Johnson factor matters in every case. And when you're talking about fee allocation, what matters is relative contribution among the attorneys to the litigation. And the district court clearly considered that. And I would argue that his consideration takes into account the fact that, results achieved, the most important factor, what the district court was doing was which attorneys are most responsible for the results achieved. Second, novelty, complexity of the litigation, difficulty of the legal issues. The money awarded in the jurisdictional pools covered all of the really complicated legal issues that the district court outlined in his order awarding the aggregate fee. That was work that was performed by the leadership attorneys and the other attorneys awarded from the jurisdictional pools. The work that Mr. Isaacson's clients performed that they cite, the district court characterized as mostly clerical, mostly administrative. So those were not complex, novel factors. He recognized that. That's clearly inherent in his determinations of relative contribution.
But just to follow up with Judge McHugh's question, now Mr. Isaacson's argued that that may well be good in and of itself, but MDL, the CLC, argued to the special master and Judge Lundstrom that the Kansas pool needed to be half of the entirety in order to pay firms like Toops Kaufman. And then when it came time to allocation, MDL counsel seemed to forget that.
Yeah, and that's incorrect, Your Honor. That's absolutely not true. And I can quote from our pleadings, but if you look at our very initial fee application to Judge Lundstrom, the Kansas CLC, docket 3867, we heavily criticized the Lodestar of the Toops Kaufman Plaintiffs' Counsel. They purport to have spent $25 million for cases that were stayed for the entire litigation. They only filed 75% of their 9,000 cases, and most of those were filed after class certification had been granted in the litigation. They only served 870 plaintiff fact sheets, the only discovery obligation anyone who filed a case, if you were not in the Bellwether pool, the only discovery obligation you had performed. They only served 870 out of their 9,000 clients, yet they report 22,000 hours on plaintiff fact sheet work. We said it's subject to serious doubt, Joint Appendix 4061. It's unsupportable, Joint Appendix 63. Noting that they reported $687 an hour for the task of file management on the same page. If you go through it, we repeatedly criticized that Lodestar. when the special master issued her report and we responded to the objections, we did note that Toops and Kaufman was put in Kansas, even though they performed work in Illinois, but only to respond to others who had said, we have too many people in Illinois that shouldn't be here because they also perform work in Kansas. But we were very clear in that filing that we were not endorsing their entire Lodestar. I think we said it here at Joint Appendix 5210. The Lodestar is entirely ungrounded to their overall contributions to the case. Docket 3867 on pages 62 to 64, we specifically said we would have to conduct further review of this Lodestar before we could determine a specific fee because we had to determine what all this work was and how it contributed to the settlement. After that was fully briefed, Judge Lumpstrom agreed with our arguments that the Toops-Kaufman plaintiffs had failed was his word, to identify or explain how this work contributed to the settlement. That's the finding below. There is absolutely no evidence that was presented on appeal to disturb that particular finding. I would like to move on, unless there's more questions on the Lodestar issue, to this issue of the fee contracts. Because I think this is an important issue. And I'm happy to hear that they are not seeking to enforce the fee contracts against their clients, because that was going to be my first point. They are not seeking to enforce contingent fees. The money's been paid to their clients. They did not file a lien. They have never even put the contracts into evidence in the record below. There's nowhere in the record where you will see the particular contracts or determine whether those, what they say. So for that reason, the contracts are irrelevant here. The issue on appeal is fee allocation between groups of attorneys. The attorneys that they're seeking fees from were not parties to those contracts. So the fact that they got a client to sign a 38 or 35 or 33% contract doesn't say anything about how the money in the common fund should be divided among attorneys. They're just simply not parties to the contract. Judge Lumpstrom abrogated those agreements to protect class members from paying double or paying additional fees because he found it would be unreasonable to allow attorneys to collect on their entire contracts when the attorneys did not do the work to create the settlement fund that those clients participated in. And I would submit that that was within the court's inherent authority and that they had waived below any suggestion the court did not have the inherent authority to do that. Doesn't sound like they're arguing that here today. Finally, let me discuss something about the additioning on this issue of the IRPA pool. The district court awarded $60.4 million to the retained attorneys just for having a client who participated in the settlement. You know, that fee alone would be a massive fee in any class action. And that was available to attorneys who didn't have to litigate at all their clients' claims. The district court found specifically that the Kansas appellants were relieved of having to advance lawsuits or add value to their clients' claims. The special master found they did little work besides recruiting clients and filling out fact sheets. At the end of the day, the mass tort sort of way of doing business that they engaged in here, as I think one of the judges, Judge Holmes, I think you recognized, Judge Bachrach, it can be a labor intensive endeavor. And the law firms who engage in that have the obligation to be efficient and to find ways to take advantages of economies of scale. And if they don't do that, and if they spend, tens of thousands of hours on tasks that don't advance the litigation, they can't come in later and say that they have been undercompensated, particularly when they have ridden on the backs of the lawyers who were prosecuting the litigation. And this case is unique in the sense that we had class actions that were litigated, certified, and tried to judgment. We had the Kansas class was a $217.7 million liability that Syngenta faced, reduced to judgment at the time of the settlement. The Minnesota class presented Syngenta with $500 million in liability. There were billions of dollars at stake in the remaining certified classes that Syngenta had to go to trial on in the 12 months after the settlement was reached, if they had not settled. So this was a case where Syngenta was facing immense pressure from the class actions, immense pressure from lawyers who had proven the ability to win at trial on very difficult facts and on very difficult law. And, that was what drove the litigation. That's what the special master who oversaw the settlement negotiation said. That's what Judge Lumstrom found, and that's what Judges Miller and Herndon from the other jurisdictions agreed with. And in light of all of those facts, the idea that these individually retained attorneys had performed what they claimed were tens of thousands of hours telling their clients and giving them status updates about the litigation, that could have been done in a more efficient manner. And that was their obligation, knowing the immense pressure that these class actions were doing to drive the litigation, which created the settlement that their clients ultimately were able to participate in. I want to correct one thing. I think it was suggested that Toops Hoffman spent only 33,000 hours on their cases. They actually report 69,000 hours on cases that were stayed. That's in the record. That includes them and their affiliated counsel. So there was just never an explanation as to why these numbers were so high, given the limited amount of work that the attorneys had to do. I see that my time is nearly up, so I would just conclude that I would urge the court to affirm, or if it finds that there's a jurisdictional question, at least abate so that we can get this final ERPA allocation figured out and we could get an opinion and not have to start this whole process over. But appreciate the court's time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. They had no problem with Toops Hoffman's lodestar when the court used it to allocate one-third of the fund as attorney's fees. They then cited Toops Hoffman and Hossley Embry's hours with respect to getting almost half of that sum allocated to the Kansas fund. And once it was allocated to the Kansas fund and the judge put them in charge of divvying up the fees within the Kansas pool, at that point, they started attacking Toops Hoffman's lodestar. And it was waived. They relied on it when they got a third of the fund as attorney's fees. They relied on it when they got almost half of that sent to the Kansas pool for them to allocate. They can't then turn around and say, oh, but we don't like the Toops Hoffman lodestar or Hosley's lodestar at that point. It's just not right. It's not fair for them to take money from Toops and Hosley and give it to themselves, giving themselves multipliers of three times, more than three times their reasonable hourly rates. Now, the Supreme Court says that you got to honor contracts, fee contracts. It said that in U.S. Airways versus McCutcheon and said common fund principles don't override individual fee contracts.
Well, in McCutcheon, it's if the contract specifically addresses the particular issue. But if the contract is ambiguous on the question or there's a gap, as the Supreme Court said, it's silent, then you can look to common fund principles. In fact, that is what happened in McCutcheon.
Well, that is what happened in McCutcheon, but here you've got retainer agreements that say 30% or that say 38% of your recovery. That's not ambiguous.
38. Earlier in your argument, you acknowledged that these are only persuasive by analogy. You started your argument and answered my question saying that no, those are not applicable to the issue that we have in front of us now, i.e. how to allocate to each piece of the puzzle in the Kansas pool.
I did not mean to say that, Your Honor.
Oh, I heard you say that too. And so, yeah, I think there's a need for clarification.
I mean, what I meant to say was that we're not trying to enforce these fee agreements against the clients at this point. What I'm saying is the judge could not abrogate those fee agreements without ensuring that we would get similar payment.
Well, so you want a better deal than the contingent fee agreement because in the contingent fee agreement, you'd be responsible for all of the expenses. Here, the court has the expenses being paid by out of the plaintiff's recovery and not out of the attorney's one-third. But in the contingent fee agreements, the expenses would come from the one-third assigned to the attorneys, right?
I'm not certain, Your Honor. But the fact is that we're not trying to get a better deal than the contingent fee agreements. We're trying to get the deal of the contingent fee agreements. If you override the agreement, you ought to make sure that the lawyers get paid what they had under the agreement because the amount is reasonable.
Well, the agreements aren't even in the record, if I understand from Mr. Wilders, right? So, I mean, how could they have such power in the allocation of fees when they're not even in the record?
We've submitted them to the IRPA special master. We've submitted all of the attorney's fee contracts in the IRPA to the IRPA special master.
You're talking about what the allocation was vis-a-vis the geographic pools. And so the point would be whether they would have been presented in the when the divvying up was taking place relative to that, right?
Well, I think the way the whole thing was done is a problem. We objected at the outset that we don't know how things are going to work out with this four-pool, three-judge process. You don't have standards here. You ought to wait until we know what the claims are and have the hard facts before we're talking about the attorney's fees. And this court held in Sears that a court cannot just toss out a contingent fee agreement. It was a 40% contingent fee agreement. It cited the Third Circuit's Dunn case to say we'd be loath to disregard the fee agreements.
Okay,
and
so let's say
go ahead, Judge Becker.
Sorry. One of the arguments that Mr. Wilders made in his brief is these are all plaintiff's lawyers. Everybody had contingency fee agreements. So if we enforce, if Judge Lundstrom were to say we're going to enforce all of the contingency fee agreements, if I'm one of the plaintiff's lawyers and I've got a 50% contingency fee, and let's say I, you know, lined up 100,000 farmers and they have, say, half of the acreage for this whole settlement, well, you know, I may not have done any work other than retaining clients, but, you know, I'm going to get 25% of $500 million. But even if you put that aside, how do you enforce all of the contingency fee agreements? If Mr. Wilders has a 50% contingency fee, he gets 50% from what his clients get. If somebody's get 40%, they get 40%. Well, get back to Judge Holmes' original question, earlier question, isn't that completely going to destroy the whole concept of a common benefit pool? There is no common benefit pool.
Well, the way things were set up initially in the term sheet was to have two pools. There was going to be a class action pool in Kansas, and there was going to be an individual action IRPA pool to be administered in Texas. And that would have ensured that the contractual rights of IRPA plaintiff's lawyers were protected.
And we're way beyond that, Mr. Isaacson. No one objected, am I correct, to the geographic pools per se, the concept of the geographic pools?
The concept of the geographic pools was, I think, a problem for Toops Kaufman because we didn't know how this stuff was going to come out.
Didn't it become a problem when you just didn't get what you thought you were entitled to out of the geographic? Right. That's you're going back to saying they could have divvied this up a different way and had a different pool structure. But the point I'm making is there was no objection to the pool structure per se, was there?
Yes, there was. Yes, there most definitely was. The Toops Kaufman objected to the pool structure and contended that there ought to be a decision after all of the claims had come in. Yes, we did object to the pool structure. I see my time has run. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
None here.
And I have to say, when it comes to abatement or dismissal, I can't come up with a good reason for why you would have power to abate.
All right. Thank you, counsel. As I indicated before, we're going to take a 10-minute break. And then come back for the other segments of this litigation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, judges. Thank you, counsel. Court is now in recess for a 10-minute break. The Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit.
All right. Counsel for appellants, Minnesota appellants, would you please make your appearance, please?
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Christina Nielsen. I represent the Minnesota appellants. And I think that you have been given quite a bit of information, very useful information, by esteemed counsel on both sides of the Kansas appeal. One of the things that I believe was asked of Mr. Isaacson was regarding finality and whether or not this court had the authority to abate pending additional orders coming down. And I wanted to direct this court perhaps to a couple of cases that might be instructive on this issue. There's a case in the 10th Circuit, Ordonez, O-R-D-O-N-E-Z versus Aviation. And while the appeal was pending, there was a motion to reconsider in the district court. This court abated the appeal. And then when the final judgment came down, the court lifted the abatement and an amended notice of appeal was filed. There are a couple of other cases that are similar. Oh, that case number was 17-4188. There are a couple of other cases that would be instructive on this issue, and that is Rivero, R-I-V-E-R-O, 950 Fed 3rd, 754. And then U.S. versus Bowen, 936 Fed 3rd, 1091. After the briefing and after oral argument in the Bowen case, the abatement, there was an abatement after oral argument and after briefing. There was a Supreme Court decision in another case, and then this court lifted the abatement and ordered supplemental briefing. So this court does have the option of abating even after oral arguments until that IRPA order comes down.
It's Ms. Nielsen, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Correctly. I think the question is not really whether we can abate after oral argument. The question is whether we can abate given the question of whether we have jurisdiction at all. I mean, I take it that the United States versus Bowen case as a criminal case, and we may well have had appellate jurisdiction to entertain Bowen and may have, I don't know the case, but I mean, it's not unusual that we would have a Supreme Court case that would be looming and we would just wait for the Supreme Court case. That's a distinct matter from the question of whether, as a matter of Article III subject matter jurisdiction, we have appellate jurisdiction to decide the thing, and whether we therefore can say, okay, even though we have serious doubts about our jurisdiction, we'll abate, we'll take action to abate and allow for further proceedings to go on below. So that's the distinction that I think is relevant here. And were these cases addressing that type of situation?
Not specifically, but I think they are still instructive on the issue. And I also think it's interesting because my clients, the Shields Law Group and Paul Byrd Law Firm, actually argued both sides of this finality argument or this finality issue. Initially, we argued that it was final or final enough. If you look at the Interfaith case, it was a long-term case. There were a lot of things going on, a lot of fee orders coming down, and the court said it is final enough for us to take a look at, and rendering a decision now would smooth the road later on for the additional fee awards that would be coming down. We later argued, look, we know that, or we had been told back in early 2020 that the IRPA order was going to come down very soon. And based on that, we said, well, let's go ahead and keep the matter abated. Obviously, that order hasn't come down, although now we think it may very soon. There's been some movement in the trial court or in the district court to rearrange some money so that payments could go out under the IRPA. So we believe that based on that, that maybe there would be a final order coming down in the IRPA. Nevertheless, hopefully we have tried to address your jurisdictional and finality concerns. And if I may, I would like to jump into the issue that is somewhat separate from the Toups-Kaufman issue, the Kansas issue, and that is the joint prosecution agreement. And, if you take a step back and you think, this is just attorneys fighting about money. We think it's actually more than that. It factors into whether or not individual clients can hire contingent fee attorneys. Because there was the mass action, the individually represented plaintiffs, which my clients represented. And then there was the class action. And as this thing progressed, as this thing came towards settlement, the mass actions were lumped with the class actions. And that's how the one pool, four pot process came down. There was an initial term sheet that would have separated the two, mass action and class action. That term sheet was rejected by certain attorneys in favor of this four pot process. So the individual clients that my clients represented could have opted out of this class settlement. But what would have happened if they had done that is, according to the terms of the class action of the class, which the district court certified, and pursuant to the terms of the Syngenta agreement, the farmers that my clients represented would not have been able to even get a ask for a trial date until a year after the settlement program had ended. And as we know, that settlement program is still ongoing. So based on the fact that the farmers' claims or cases would have been delayed indefinitely, that there were potentially millions at risk for the farmers, my clients had to do what was best for those farmers, and that is recommend that they be lumped in to the class. Then the court says, okay, we're going to separate it into the four-pot process. And much like Toops Kaufman in the Kansas situation, the co-lead counsel for Minnesota, the Minnesota counsel, took the hours that my clients devoted to the individual clients, took those hours to justify the one-third total attorney's fees. And then once they justified the one-third total attorney's fees, then they told my clients that their hours were being cut, that that wasn't truly common benefit. And the result of that was all of this time that my clients had spent on doing court-ordered plaintiff fact sheets, that time was cut. When Minnesota lead counsel told the court that the PFSs were common benefit in the truest sense, that is their quote, in the truest sense, they get the one-third and then they cut out my clients. And the purpose of that was so that leadership could walk away with, in my client's situation, between $6 and $8 million more, because my clients were denied their hourly lodestar. And
how did the joint prosecution agreement play into this? I mean, what is their significance in your argument? I'm trying to get clear on that.
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. So the joint prosecution agreement, the JPA, was entered into very early on in the case, before the class was certified. It was an agreement between Minnesota counsel and Kansas counsel, and that provided for the division of fees in the event that there was a settlement with Syngenta. Then the settlement comes about.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Gibson, before you move on with the chronology, in that original JPA, am I correct that neither Byrd nor Shields were a party to the original JPA?
We were a party to we signed the addendum to the JPA.
When you say we, Byrd.
Yes, Your Honor, Byrd and Shields.
And Shields never signed on to the addendum, right?
He did, Your Honor.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yes. So my clients were both signatories to the JPA.
All right. Through the addendum.
Yes.
Good.
And then, okay, so the JPA was in place. Everybody operated under the terms of the JPA. When the Kansas case went to trial, my clients who were assigned to the Minnesota pool or had many of their cases in the Minnesota pool, they worked with the damages experts in Kansas for the benefit of the Kansas case. So you've got firms who are working across borders here, including my clients. But then at the last minute, once the Syngenta case was settled, then there was a last minute, what we like to refer to as the secret fee deal among certain attorneys, not including Byrd and Shields. And that secret fee deal, that last minute renegotiation of how fees should be distributed, which majority of counsel did not agree to, changed the JPA. It changed how the court should distribute the fees. And that is the agreement that the court relied on to distribute this money into the four pots.
The court gave it, said it somewhat supported the decision that the court made. I mean, I think that the argument that the court basically said, I'm just following this, isn't really consistent with the record here. The court made its decision based on a determination of the qualitative value of the particular tasks performed by different attorneys. Is that fair?
Judge McHugh, I don't believe that it is necessarily fair to say that the district court engaged in a qualitative analysis of the relative contributions of the various law firms. The court did rely on the last minute fee distribution agreement among some firms. It did give some weight to that. But
it made a decision, it said people who actually went to trial and obtained a jury verdict did work that is valued greater than people who filled out plaintiff fact sheets. That's a qualitative analysis, right?
That is a qualitative analysis. But there was no qualitative analysis as to the contribution that the plaintiff fact sheets gave to the overall litigation. Because the plaintiff fact sheets, PFSs, were court ordered. And the court ordered them because that's how Syngenta knew how much the damages were. And so my clients completed these over 4,000 plaintiff fact sheets that the court required. And then the court depended the value of that PFS, which the court obviously thought was necessary and valuable to the overall litigation. Then the court decided that if you happened to be assigned to the Minnesota pool, that plaintiff fact sheet is only worth 300. But if you had the benefit or the luxury of being assigned to the Kansas pool, that same fact sheet was worth $600.
Yeah, and I agree with you. That's difficult to justify.
Thank you, Your Honor. We believe it is, too, and it cost our clients $3 million.
Well, the question was whether there's a diminishing return on those plaintiff fact sheets. I mean, you start out with the initial fact sheets, and then you keep bringing them in. It's not clear that every fact sheet thereafter is created equal. It seems to me that was the rationale for it, was it not?
That is what the court said.
Where did you make this JPA argument before the district court?
I do not have the exact site. The exact
talking about Byrd and Shield. Those right. Clients. Where did they make that argument?
We made it most recently in a motion for reconsideration. We also made it whenever the Minnesota court came down with its order allocating fees.
And what I want to be clear on is the distinction between Watts Gura in arguments that they made. They're no longer here.
Correct.
In arguments that you've made. I mean, when I look at, for example, page, I guess, 5 and 6 of the Minnesota appellate's opening brief, there are a list of issues there. And it's not clear to me that all those issues were issues as to which Byrd and Shield, distinctly from Watts Gura, made objections. That's a difficult thing to get at. But the point is, unless it's clear that you either accepted that expressly adopted the objections of Watts Gura on the record, that their objections aren't your objections.
Their objections wouldn't be our objections unless we adopted them or stated them on our own.
Correct. And so the point's going to be, whether when you cited preservation issues, cited where you preserved arguments in your briefing, that it's clear that you cited where you either adopted it or you made it, right?
That is correct. And I believe.
I'm not going to ask you to find them all now. I don't want to take your time up. But the point I'm making is you accept that premise. Because when I started looking through the briefing, it wasn't clear to me that every argument that Watsgura made and that is now before us were arguments that your clients made individually or adopted. But you accept the premise that you either have to adopt it or you have to make it, right?
Correct. And to the extent we did not make it clear in our brief, Your Honor, we can provide you with citation to where we made those objections and preserve the issue for appeal.
All right, go ahead.
All right.
Can I back up into your exchange with Judge McHugh about the fact that a PFS in Kansas is worth $600 and in Minnesota it's worth $300? Let's say hypothetically that you have $100 in the Kansas pool. And let's just say hypothetically you have $100 in the Minnesota pool and you have 100 lawyers battling for that $100 in Minnesota, and you have 50 that are battling for that $100 in Kansas. Well, if you're administering the Kansas pool and you're administering the Minnesota pool, isn't that one good reason that you would be able to give twice as much for an individual PFS in Kansas as opposed to Minnesota, even if the pools are the same? In other words, isn't the driving factor the number of lawyers that were battling for a piece of the pie? And the reality is there were just a whole bunch more in Minnesota than there was in Kansas.
I would say that, one, if the JPA had been followed, that wouldn't have been a concern at all. Or if the JPA had been considered and not completely thrown out, then the allocation as far as who got what is on the PFSs would not be as a big a concern or a concern at all. And secondly, with respect to the force of the JPA or the force of the PFSs, which jurisdictions were more important? Even if you assume that that is valid, that the earlier JPA, the earlier PFSs meant more than later submitted PFSs, then it was incumbent, we believe, on the district court to decide which of those PFSs were first, right? If you assume that the first submitted PFSs are more important, but there is no analysis as far as which PFS came first, how can the district court justify giving twice as much to Kansas than they did Minnesota?
Right. So your position is if you want to, first of all, I'm not sure that the court, the Minnesota state court, did not hold that they had diminishing value. In fact, said just the opposite. Everyone keeps quoting the part of that decision where the court is restating the position of the CLC's position on that point. But even if you were going to say that they diminish, wouldn't you have to decide what date they were collected and say, okay, up to this date, no matter which state you're in, they have this value, but after this date, they have a different value. And I don't see anything that explains why geography matters more than date if you're saying that they diminish in value because at some point you have enough to put the fear in Syngenta and additional ones have diminishing returns. What difference does it make if it's Kansas or Illinois or Minnesota?
I would not disagree. Geography seemed to matter a lot in how the distributions were made.
Well, that's the point, geography and not timing. I mean, if it is geography, if it's diminishing value, yes, but it's not temporally necessarily diminishing value. It's diminishing value of PFSs in connection with lawyers contributing to the result. And so if the PFSs are linked to lawyers who are contributing to the result, i.e. Kansas contributing more than Minnesota, then that logic is not strictly one of a timeline, is it?
It is not strictly a timeline. No, it's also a matter of common benefit contribution.
Which is what we're talking about, which gets us back to the question of what relevance are the JPAs. If we're talking about, at the end of the day, who ended up contributing more? You talked about the when these JPAs were entered. When the JPAs were entered, nobody had any idea how this thing was going to play out, did they?
That is true. But if
you didn't have an idea how it was going to play out, we know now how it plays out. And the court is charged with saying what is reasonable based upon what the world is now as to who contributed more. Why should they matter?
Because there has to be a way for attorneys and their clients to go into litigation having a reasonable basis on which to know how they are going to be compensated. And if contracts at the beginning, which the law favors, are completely disregarded, then how can clients pursue cases? How can contingent fee attorneys take cases? And how can mass actions survive and not let everything be subsumed by class actions, in which we all know that in class actions, it's usually not the clients, it's not the plaintiffs, it's not the injured who recover, it's usually the attorneys. So the law, I believe, is very clear that the ex ante contracts provide substantial basis for which the courts should rely and should consider in evaluating what the parties understood their contributions would be. And I see that I am out of time, and I'd be happy to continue answering questions, but would respectfully request that the court allow at least a minute in rebuttal.
A minute will be provided. Now, let's go on to Mr. Wilder. Oh, I'm sorry, Judge.
Do you mind if I ask one question?
No, please go ahead.
So I just wanted to ask Ms. Nielsen, in the joint prosecution agreement, since Byrd and Shields were not signatories to the original agreement, they joined as part of the addendum. I want to go back to Mr. Wilder's argument in his brief that Byrd and Shields joined the agreement based on page 3166 of the joint appendix that, as you point out, refers to additional Minnesota counsel individual cases. And in that provision, as the appellees have noted, it specifically refers to the subject matter of the joint prosecution agreement as being the assessments on individual cases set forth therein. The rejoinder of Byrd and Shields in the reply brief is, well, of course, they're only referring to individual cases because that's what the heading is, additional Minnesota counsel individual cases. The problem I have with your argument in your reply is that's the only provision that in which Byrd and Shields ever became a party to the joint prosecution agreement at all. Do you understand my question? My question is, why doesn't the joint prosecution agreement with not to Watson Gura, but with regard to Byrd and Shields only apply by virtue of page 3166 because Byrd and Shields were both in additional Minnesota counsel, and they then joined an agreement in which it specifically defined what the JPA refers to as being the assessments on individual cases set forth here and not classes.
Because hopefully I'm answering your question, Your Honor.
If you don't understand it, then I'm going to try again. I don't want you to guess at my question. Do you want me to clarify my question?
If you don't mind, Your Honor.
Okay. So I'll just take it in baby steps. You're not saying, okay, let's look at the joint prosecution agreement to see what it covers. You're saying they became a party through the addendum. So let's look at what the addendum covers. Maybe it incorporates the original agreement. Maybe it doesn't. On page 3166 of the record, the addendum says, there are other lawyers like Byrd and Shields that can become party to this original agreement. And in doing that, it specifically lays out in that very provision in which Byrd and Shields can become party to the original JPA, that it only applies to assessments on individual cases. Now, the appellees made that argument in the red brief, and then your reply brief, whoever wrote the reply brief, their rejoinder sounds good, but it doesn't make any sense to me when you look at the document, because the argument in the reply was, well, the heading is referring to individual cases. Well, that's right, but that's the same provision that allowed Burden Shields ever to become a party to the agreement at all. So the very provision that allowed Burden Shields to become parties to the JPA specified that it only applies to assessments on individual cases, not class, not anything relating to a class.
When my clients who represented individuals were subsumed into the class, the Minnesota cases that my clients had were obviously individual cases, right? So when the addendum was created, it was because they needed my clients' cases to be filed in Minnesota to create more pressure on Syngenta. And even though the JPA refers to individual clients, that's what my individual farmers, individual cases, that's what my clients had. And it wasn't until the Syngenta settlement agreement was finalized that my clients could either opt out of the class, or if they opted into the class, then they would be party to whatever settlement provisions there were. Now, even if the JPA isn't controlling in this case, it should at least provide some guidance to the district court. The district court should not have just ignored it. And I believe that the sixth Johnson factor refers to agreements among counsel. And even the addendum provided for some measure of the agreement between the parties and what they expected to get in return for their representation, for their involvement in not only the individual mass cases, but in the class as well.
So other than by analogy, am I correct in thinking that you're not arguing that if a judge were to say, okay, I'm going to enforce the addendum, that Bird and Shields will pay an assessment on any of the funds that their clients received through this class settlement, because the addendum by its terms only applied to assessments based on payments for individual cases, and Burden Shields clients didn't get anything from individual cases. They got money through a class settlement. But you're acknowledging that the addendum doesn't, by its terms, apply to any of the money that Burden Shields clients got, but that, like Toops Kaufman, you're arguing that it should apply by analogy. Is that fair?
That would be fair, Your Honor. And we do believe that, at least Bird and Shields do believe that the addendum and the JPA required them to pay assessments. And if the JPAs are enforced, they would be required to pay assessments on their clients' recoveries.
For individual cases.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Judge Holmes.
Sure, of course. Mr. Walters.
Thank you. May it please the court. I want to address both the JPA issue and the plaintiff fact sheets. But before I do that, I want to make really clear that the Minnesota appellants and everybody really in the litigation, when they perform substantive work on the litigation, when they helped on any, if they ever helped on a class action, or they took depositions, or even if one of their clients was called up as a bellwether, and they had to produce them for a deposition or do that, they could submit that time. And the court made clear that on top of the IRPA allocation, they could submit that time, and they were all paid for that time. They were paid not only their lodestar, but a multiplier for that time. And that's true across the litigation. So
They were paid through the Minnesota pool, you're saying?
The Minnesota appellants were paid through the Minnesota pool, and the Kansas appellants were paid through the Kansas pool. Yes, that's true for everyone. So everyone was treated equally on terms with, in sense of, if you contributed to the overall settlement, if you contributed to the overall litigation, you were paid according to those contributions and according to the recommendations. Now, let me address first the joint prosecution agreements. And I understand Judge Bacharach's question, which is a good one, which is the Minnesota appellant brief in responding to the addendum tried to distinguish the fact that the assessments applied on individual cases in terms that may have a defense that may have applied to Watsquiera because they were parties to the original JPA. It's not a defense that applies to the Minnesota appellants because it is true. They didn't join until the addendum. Shields joined on November 22nd, 2016. That's at the joint appendix, page 1895. And Byrd signed in January of 2016, slightly earlier. That's in the joint appendix at 3169, 3172. So it's absolutely true that when they joined these agreements, they had to have fully understood that they did not apply to a class recovery. And the district court and the special master and the other two judges, they gave this there was a lot of briefing on the joint prosecution agreements below. And the special master, what she concluded was the joint prosecution agreements obviously did not contemplate a nationwide settlement class. And it was, quote, clear they did not govern such a circumstance. And the district court, when he reviewed the report and recommendation, he agreed. And he said, these apply to multiple separate litigations and by their terms do not apply to the present situation. And that's true because the very premise of the joint prosecution agreements were that these lawyers wanted to not participate in any litigation or settlement class. And the agreements provided them with a mechanism to say, I represent these clients. These clients don't want to be in your class. I've confirmed that that is in their best interests, and I'm going to exclude them. Here's their identities. And if they did that, they're out of the class. So what they got in exchange for the joint prosecution agreements was access to the work product of the leadership attorneys, just access, so that they could use that work to obtain a recovery, whether by trial or settlement on their own. And in that circumstance, they paid this very modest or more modest assessment to the leadership attorneys for access to their work product. It wasn't intended, and nowhere in there did it govern what would happen if there was a single settlement fund and everyone had to figure out a way how to divide that up.
And I think I understand what you're saying on that. The alternative argument that they make is even if it didn't apply, that the Judge Lundstrom was required to at least consider it in some fashion, to give it some weight. And how do you respond to that? That it was a relevant factor.
Sure. And I think he would have been entitled to give it some weight, but he concluded it wasn't entitled to weight because it didn't apply and because it was applied to a different circumstance. So, you know, in a way, maybe it's a semantic distinction, but he determined it wasn't entitled to wait because it hadn't been an agreement for this circumstance. And we laid out a lot of reasons in our brief as to why they would be treated differently in this single settlement fund versus separate funds. Because if you're going to say, hey, you only have to pay 11% and you get to use our work product, but then you have to go out and try cases and you have to go out and settle cases, that's a much different scenario than leadership coming and saying, hey, here's a settlement, a $1.51 billion settlement. All your clients have to do to participate is fill out a very simple claim form, and we're going to use government data to determine their allocation. So the JPA doesn't reflect the relative contributions to this settlement. And I want to correct something, which is there was a qualitative assessment. The special master also considered these issues, and she found it should not be given weight. The district judge found it as well, as did the Illinois and Minnesota judges. And I think in terms of its applicability, it's important to note that even the original JPA only apply to assessments ordered by the federal or state courts. That was how the assessments were defined by the agreement. And the common benefit order that the court entered in conjunction with these initial JPAs specifically provided that no assessment would be ordered on a class recovery. So at the time that Shields and Byrd firms joined the agreement for the addendum, even putting aside the language of the addendum for a moment, they knew that there wasn't going to be an assessment if their clients participated in the class recovery, because the court said from the get-go it was not going to order assessments on a class recovery. It would divide the fee according to a further order of the court. And that was very clear, both at the beginning of the process, before the JPAs were signed, and certainly after the JPAs were signed, and that that order was entered.
Let me ask you a record fact or a factual question. You had said, I think, or the appellees had said that the form for the CBO was provided and I think circulated at the same time as the JPA. Is that in the record that it was contemporaneous? In other words, that if you were a signatory to the JPA, that you would have known what Judge Lundstrom was going to eventually be asked to sign as the CBO?
Yeah, so the email, I think it's an email attaching the CBO draft, and I know it went to the Watts-Guerra firm and the other signatories, is at the record at Joint Appendix 520. I think that's in Volume 2. It's docket 286-1 on page 19. So the form of the CBO did not change throughout these negotiations. This language in there about the CBO not, or the assessments not applying to a class recovery was there from before the JPA was signed. It was there when the JPA was signed. It was subsequently entered by the district court when the JPA was incorporated into the CBO. And so it was certainly there when the Shields and Byrd firms signed the addendum. At all points during that process, it was clear that the assessments would not be ordered on a class recovery, and the JPAs only apply to assessments that the court ordered. And I would further point out, well, I guess let me, if there's no other questions on the JPA, let me move on to the issue of the amounts that Shields and Byrd were allocated from the Minnesota allocation. Let me correct two statements that were made. One, if a lawyer wanted to opt their clients out of the settlement class, there was a favored nations clause, but it's not still in effect. They could have opted them out and they could have settled those cases on their own on the same terms as the settlement agreement, the class settlement agreement, without violating that favored nations clause. If they wanted to pursue their cases and get a trial date, they had to wait until a year after the final effective date of the settlement. That was many years ago now. That was when the appeals to the actual settlement were approved. It does not continue into this date. And that's at the Joint Appendix 1067. Second, in terms of allocating among the jurisdictions, there has been this repeated assertion that there was a secret fee deal. There was no secret to the fee deal. The fee agreement that was executed between leadership was in the record from multiple times from the point when all applications were made. It was extensively covered in all of the briefing. It wasn't a secret. It's just that not everyone was a party to it, but it was basically a recommendation to the court of what some of the leadership, the leading lawyers who did all of the substantive work to obtain the settlement thought would be a fair way to allocate the fee. And it left 20% of the fee unallocated for the court and the special master to decide how to allocate that money amongst the applications. And it ultimately decided to give 10% of that back to the Minnesota allocation, increasing what the fee agreement had recommended. And then it gave 10%, ultimately 12%, to the IRPA pool. So let me address this point about the differences in the plaintiff fact sheet compensations between Minnesota and Kansas. First, this idea that if the fact sheets had diminishing returns, it was incumbent upon the court to decide when those fact sheets were entered. And Judge McHugh, I will get to your question about...
Well, before you jump in with the assumption that the court decided they had diminishing returns, can you give me a record site where it is the court itself saying they have diminishing returns and not the court quoting an argument from a party saying they have diminishing returns?
I guess the opinion's a little strange in that she does discuss Minnesota leadership's recommendation. They made the argument that it was diminishing returns. She ultimately, and this is at the beginning of her order at 6711, she adopts in part the recommendations of leadership.
But she also says that she recognizes that no individual PFS provided a greater benefit than any other PFS. That's a quote.
Yes. And let me just be clear, the argument was made about the diminishing returns by Minnesota leadership. These appellants did not object to that argument. They didn't ask the district court to say, well, if you're going to accept this diminishing returns argument, you've got to look at when they were served. They didn't make that argument.
Well, because she didn't accept the argument. She said they don't have no individual PFS provided a greater benefit than any other.
But the point they were making about diminishing returns, and I agree with Judge Bachrach's earlier questions about that, which is it was the number of PFSs. If you had taken the current Minnesota...
Where does a judge say that?
Please. Well, I don't think she makes that express finding, but she did agree with the recommendation as to how much a PFS was valued in Minnesota. And the issue is, if you took away the 5,000 or so PFSs that were served by the Minnesota appellants in Minnesota, you would still have over 50,000 PFSs served in that jurisdiction. So the point being that it's sort of common sense, which is there's only so many cases the court system can try. And once you hit critical mass, there really isn't a significant additional value to more.
But did she ever even consider that in Kansas they'd be 600?
She did. I mean, that argument was raised to her. And she determined that in Minnesota, that $301 was fair compensation for the common benefit conferred by the PFS-related work without overcompensating for such work. And that was on page 6744 of the joint appendix. And there are really two parts to that. One is that the PFSs served in Kansas, and by the way, the PFSs were served first in Kansas before they were served in Minnesota, because that jurisdiction was filed first and prosecuted first. And the PFSs in Minnesota were largely served by the Watts-Guerra group. And so the defendants, Syngenta, would have faced individual lawsuits of a significant magnitude of over 50,000 lawsuits, even if these Minnesota appellants had never filed their cases. So it could have been that, you know, there was a different way to allocate the PFSs. But ultimately, when you're talking about the relative value of the PFSs as a whole, you know, awarding it at $600 would have been excessive in Minnesota, given that there were so many of them and they didn't all have the same. They had a different value in the aggregate than they had in the individual.
I wish I could see that clearly in the decision, but I don't.
What do you understand to be the rationale of the decision?
I don't think it is.
I'm asking him. I mean, what do you understand to be the rationale for the decision of the Minnesota judge relative to its, discounting is the wrong word, but relative to it assessing a different value to the PFS?
Well, I think there's part of two rationales, and I think she sets it out on 6744 and 45. She determines that to provide more compensation from the amount that was allocated to Minnesota would overcompensate for that work relative to, I think, its benefit in Minnesota. And in other words, it would be overcompensation relative to the other work that occurred in Minnesota, because she would have to reduce the fees that would be awarded to the firms who did substantive work in the litigation.
Based upon the entire aggregate pot.
That's right. The amount of the pot that was allocated to Minnesota. And I do want to correct that the PFSs were not used to allocate the settlement in any way. So the notion that they had some intrinsic value beyond simply telling Syngenta that we would do this minimal clerical work in order to keep these cases alive for this point in time in the litigation, they were not used to estimate damages in the settlement. I think that was that's set forth in Joint Appendix 4110 on one of the declarations of someone who was involved in the settlement.
But Judge Lundstrom did find that they provided value that was beneficial to the settlement and to the common fund.
Absolutely. And over $17 million was allocated to firms simply for the clerical work of performing the PFS task, which just so the court knows, and I think it's cited in our abbreviations, we point the court to where the PFS is, but there was an abbreviated discovery questionnaire that had to answer a couple questions and serve a few categories of documents. And the record is also clear that firms which kept contemporaneous track of their time on the PFS reported that they had performed that task in under 2 hours. And so, you know, there was, and the district and the Minnesota court very much does acknowledge this, that there was a wide disparity among the individually retained firms as to how much time they claim to have spent on this task.
And that's part of the justification for a flat fee, right?
That was part of the justification for the flat fee. And I think that was really what she was talking about when Judge Miller made the finding that no PFS was worth more than another PFS, which was the PFS served by firm A wasn't worth more than this one served by firm B just because firm B took 7 hours or claims to have taken 7 hours and firm A took 2 hours. And I think that was more in line of what she was talking about there as opposed to explicitly rejecting the diminishing returns argument that had been presented by lead counsel in which in the report that she adopted in part only with certain modifications. She certainly didn't reject that argument when she adopted that report. I also want to point out that one other distinguishing characteristic that Judge Miller recognizes on the PFSs in Minnesota is that the individual firms in Minnesota were told in 2016 that the PFS was only going to receive a value of $150 per PFS. And that's distinguished from Kansas. There was no communication about that in Kansas. So, you know, ultimately they received double, a $301 for each PFS that was served. They received double than what they were told in 2016. So that's another factor that was true in Minnesota that wasn't true in Kansas. I also take issue with the notion that the Minnesota leadership, you know, suggested that all firms should receive their lodestar for the PFS. They gave that number that was reported to them to the court when the allocations among the jurisdictions were made. But they also said only that the court should, quote, approve some of this as common benefit time. And that's at Joint Appendix 3415. And ultimately, they asked the district court for $15 million in additional compensation in Minnesota so they could pay for the PFS work. And they ultimately approved and recommended, and Judge Miller approved $17 million. So I don't think there's any particular disparity in what was reported. The work did not have a tremendous value. It didn't cause Syngenta to have to do any work. It was merely sort of a symbolic thing to say, hey, we've got these cases and we're willing to do some work on them. And the court recognized that. And I think $18 million was a fair valuation overall for the work that was performed. If there aren't any other questions, I think I'll surrender the rest of my time and thank the court.
And I call for a reference. 1 minute.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to try to talk fast. Mr. Wilder pointed out that if they contributed to the settlement, they were paid according to their contribution, no matter where they were. That falls flat whenever you consider the Illinois allocation, in which firms were receiving millions just because money was left over in Illinois and they didn't want to send it back to the pool. The argument that the PFSs were merely symbolic, they were court ordered. And if to the extent they were clerical in nature, then why did the district court award millions to law firms for the expense of experts to complete the PFSs? You know, the if you enforce the JPA, this was never meant to be a class settlement. All of the law firms litigated under the JPA, and we would ask that they be enforced because they received the benefit of it, and we should be entitled to the benefit, and that is the compensation under the JPA.
Thank you. Case is submitted to the Minnesota portion anyway. Okay, next up is Illinois.
Good morning, and may it please the court. David Campbell here for the Illinois appellants. We only have a few minutes for argument. I'll try to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. I think that we can be brief today, Your Honors, because the point that we raised in our brief, that the trial court's exclusive jurisdiction over the allocation and distribution of attorney's fees imposes a non-delegable judicial duty on the court to meaningfully review that that allocation is undisputed in the briefing. We raised that in our opening brief, and in the responsive brief, that was undisputed. Now, what was disputed instead was an assertion that we had waived that argument below. And so in my brief time before the court, I'd like to address that in two ways. First, there was an assertion in Appellee's brief that the district court found waiver on of the Illinois appellants, and that's just not true. If you look at the record, at the judge's final allocation order, the judge, district court below, only used waiver once on JA7442. That waiver assertion was solely as to Clark and the Clark firm. It was not on behalf of any other Illinois firm in the Illinois pool, and that statement in the district court's order did not apply to any of the Illinois appellants before this court.
Yeah, well, am I correct that the Illinois pool order itself, the Kansas district court said that you never raised such objections until after the Illinois pool was allocated? And at that point, you were dissatisfied with the allocation. Is that not correct?
So Your Honor, that was couched not in terms of a waiver argument, but
whether the court called it waiver is not the point. The point for our purposes is whether we should deem it to be a waiver.
Correct. And so let me address that head on, because there was that allegation in the briefing, and there is an assertion in the district court's final allocation order that we had laid behind the log, and that is not true. The exclusive jurisdiction order established that the court had exclusive jurisdiction, and in that order, the district court expressly addressed whether or not the attorneys had waived an objection by failing to object prior to that point, and the judge expressly said in that order on page 5926 of the joint appendix that waiver did not apply. Moreover, the court went on, and I would encourage the court to focus on pages 5926 and 5927, because when that exclusive jurisdiction order was issued, the understanding that the Illinois appellants and other parties had was that the district court was going to review those allocation orders, but apply some sort of deference. And I think what the parties anticipated, you can see in two places in the record. One is if you look at the initial allocation order that the district court prepared, which is at 5347 of the record, when the district court reviewed Special Master Reisman's recommendations, the district court applied de novo review with some deference to the fact findings. And that was the understanding of the parties when the judge issued the exclusive jurisdiction order early the next year, was that that similar standard of review would apply when the court addressed the next issue. The second place,
when the district court said that initially said that the Illinois federal court alone would make the Illinois pool determination, isn't that correct? And then later it was clarified that the court would review as it relates to structural and procedural issues.
So the first time that structural and procedural came up as a term was in that exclusive jurisdiction order, which was issued back in April of 2019, before it went. If you look at the objection that was filed, that is at 6955 of the record, the understanding of the party was that that structural and procedural review meant two things. It meant, one, that the court was going to defer to the special master or to the Illinois judge regarding factual determinations, but the party's understanding was that they would still be able to raise structural or procedural issues. And one structural or procedural issue that I think is critical to our issue in this case was the fact that if you look at the reason that the district court proposed this procedure, the reason the district court gave was that those lower courts were in, let me just quote, the best position to understand the relative contributions of the attorneys. So the idea was that the district court was going to rely on those who had the most knowledge on the ground of what had been done. The reason that that became so important later is because, as the court's aware from the record, the special master who had knowledge ended up disagreeing with the newly established district court judge. And in fact, in footnote 4 of Judge Rosenstengel's recommendation, she even notes that the prior judge, Judge Herndon, who had knowledge of this, also disagreed with her. So that was where just to close out the point, that was where the parties needed the district court to step in and address that structural or procedural difficulty that was caused by multiple different special masters or judges with different opinions about how that fee should be allocated.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Lou Garrison for Illinois. Just 2 points I'd like to make. One, I believe they're saying in a rather backhanded fashion that Judge Rosenstengel was incapable of looking at the record and rendering a fair fee allocation based on that record, which I think, you know, she was capable of doing that and did so in a good way. The second point we'd like to make is that the when Special Master Reisman entered her opinion back in November of 2018, there were 10 firms that objected to her findings. This firm was not one of them. They could have, they did not. They waited to see what happened with the file allocation and then played a little bit of Monday morning quarterback here. And now they're dissatisfied with it. So we think that they did not preserve that error. I mean, that's what Judge Lungstrom found. And, you know, I would just like to say that this whole situation with this Rubik's Cube of a piece of litigation going on in three separate fronts, I've never been involved in a case that was this complex and had this many layers of review on it. And Judge Lungstrom had a special master and it just went in incredible scrutiny to try to make the right call on all these issues that are in this case. And so with respect to my colleagues here in Illinois, they just they didn't raise this at the proper time. They have not said how they would be harmed anyway. Judge Rosenstengel made a careful determination of what their hours were. And, you know, under common benefit rules, all hours are not created equal, as we've already heard argued today. An hour spent on document review is not the same as an hour spent cross-examining an expert. And while I got a little bit of time left, if you don't mind, I would just like to weigh in on this jurisdiction issue. Since, you know, the way I look at it, all the appeals here now are based on what happened with the common benefit. What are the common benefit allocations? Are they correct? Were they handled in the right way? There are two pieces of this. You got the common benefit part of it, and you got the IRPA, which doesn't have anything to do with common benefit money.
Well, doesn't it have to do with whether ultimately there is a fair allocation to lawyers? And look, I'm not diminishing the value of getting paid here. But what I'm saying is, if you've got people arguing that I should have gotten a lodestar, that means in their head, they have a figure for what it would have taken for me to be fairly compensated. And then if out of the ARPA, they get enough money that it says, oh, well, that's close enough to me being fairly compensated. Maybe that lawyer then doesn't care about pursuing the common benefit allegation because they have been paid. That's the point.
I understand, Judge Holmes, but I think the two are separate because ARPA doesn't have anything to do with common benefit. Nothing.
Don't the lawyers, appellants, have a stake in how that ARPA allocation takes place? Doesn't it affect their total compensation?
It would affect their total compensation, but only that pot of money, that $60.4 million. We know what that pot of money is. We know it's going to be divvied up according to whatever clients you had that filed claims. We know that. We've all been a part of that. The rest of this, what we're talking about today, is all on common benefit. What value did you bring to the ultimate settlement of this case? Just because you had a lot of clients and just because you reviewed a bunch of files, and just because you talked to clients on the phone doesn't mean that that drove the value of this case or drove the settlement of this case. So in my way of looking at it, Judge Holmes, I think the two are distinct. You could have it, sure, could you have an appeal that comes from ARPA? Yes. Is it going to raise anything about common benefit in the future? It will not. It will only have something to do with what happened in ARPA. It's not going to be, you're not going to hear from Toops Kaufman saying, look, we didn't get this client here that we had. It's really, it was our client. Somebody stole our client. And by the way, we need more money for all the work we did in fact sheet. That's not going to happen. So I see the two are totally distinct, Judge Holmes, respectfully. And so I think the court can certainly determine this common benefit issue, which is what we're here on. ARPA, unless the pot is changed, that amount of money, $60.4 million, is going to stay there. It's going to be the same. And everything else has to do with common benefit. What value did you bring to the deal?
Okay. I understand your position. Thank you very much. I think that's it for the Illinois segment of this litigation. We're now moving on to Johnson Becker, I believe.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Tim Becker. I'm a partner in the law firm Johnson Becker. Excuse me. Our issue is a little distinct from those that have been raised throughout the appeal today and deals specifically with what pools member participating attorneys were allowed to be in. By brief review, our firm did work in two states, Illinois and Minnesota. 30% of our cases were filed in Illinois and 40% of our traditional common benefit work was performed in Illinois. Yet we were put only into the Minnesota pool. Now that's problematic because by my review of the record, we were the only firm in the country who did work in two separate pools, but was evaluated in one. That was particularly problematic in the context of this case for three additional reasons. First, the special master during oral argument when commenting on the decision to put us into Minnesota versus both pools, or Illinois for that matter, said that you could go either way. That was a direct quote. In other words, there was no rational reason for why we were in Minnesota versus why we were in Illinois, particularly given the fact that our work in those two jurisdictions essentially mirrored each other. Second,
your other two argument reasons, Mr. Becker, let me ask you, I'm not sure that A necessarily leads to Z. In other words, if you had a substantial portion of Johnson and Becker's work that was done in Illinois and a substantial part in Minnesota, you know, perhaps one could say, well, you can be put in either one of those pools, but it's not necessarily a ridiculous or irrational consideration to say, look, I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of law firms. They have, some of these firms have thousands of suits, and that I am to require everybody to be in one pool because there's enough confusion as there is. Even with that rigid rule, that there were some firms that would be put in the, you know, there were five obviously firms that were put in the CLC for the MDL's list. for compensation in the MDL, and yet they were also in co-lead counsel's list for Minnesota. And so the judge said, okay, well, it's too confusing now. So because of all that confusion, it's not necessarily a crazy thing to say, look, everybody be in one pool.
Judge, I think that that would have been a fine rule had that been the rule that was actually followed, but that was not the rule that was followed. What ultimately happened was that those firms who did work in, and there were seven of us, or eight counting our firm, those firms who did work in multiple jurisdictions were ultimately evaluated in those separate pools.
But isn't that only because of the fortuity that I guess the MDL co-lead counsel and the Minnesota co-lead counsel didn't get the memo? I mean, that they had these five or six firms that they recommended distribution separately in Minnesota and in Kansas. And so the judge said, okay, well, what's done is done. And well, that's the reason that you were singled out.
Sure. But then that, I think, makes the rule one that is no rule at all and is ultimately what leads to the decision, or our argument rather, that the decision to put seven in two separate pools and us exclusively in one pool is arbitrary. And the reason for that is found in the special master's concession herself, where she said, we could have gone either way. We could have put them in Illinois, or we could have put them in Minnesota, or we could have put them in both.
Isn't part of the problem, though, when you made the argument? I mean, you sought clarification on this issue. You got clarification on the record. You said you were satisfied with the clarification. Am I wrong on that?
So here's what I think you're missing, Judge Holmes, is this. When Judge Longstrom gave that clarification, he said specifically and wrote in his, or said on the record that all, quote, all of the common benefit work would be, I'm inserting here, would be compensated wherever performed. Those were his words, wherever performed. The problem was, is that there were three buckets of compensation across all of the jurisdictions. Bucket one was for the PFS, as you have heard about. Bucket two was for what we called traditional notions of common benefit. And bucket three was for this broader notion of a broader common benefit. In Illinois, those firms were largely compensated based on their, quote, broader common benefit work, things that would not be traditionally found in a common benefit application. The judge in Minnesota did not award any compensation for our broader common benefit work done in Illinois.
But at the time that you sought clarification, didn't you say that you were confident that Minnesota would treat you fairly? Well, Minnesota treated you fairly. I mean, by the standards of everybody in Minnesota. So, I mean, why isn't that waiver is what I'm talking about.
Sure. Here's why it's not waiver. Number one, the harm didn't arise until the order was actually adjudicated.
Oh, you were heard, but that's different. But before the harm arose, you had an opportunity to object. You saw clarification. You got clarification. You said, I'm satisfied with the clarification, that I will be treated fairly. I mean, the notion that at the end of the day, you didn't get the money you thought you would get doesn't mean you weren't treated fairly by the lights of the Minnesota judge, right?
Well, I think this is where we part company, Your Honor. Okay. The issue is not whether or not we said we believe that the Minnesota court will do what you are telling her to do, Judge Longstrom. The issue is, what did Judge Longstrom instruct the Illinois, Minnesota, and itself to do? And what Judge Longstrom specifically said was that the work would be compensated, quote unquote, wherever performed. The problem is, if you go back to the three buckets of compensation, we were not compensated for this broader common benefit time that ultimately the Illinois court compensated those counsel for. That harm and our belief that we would be treated in all three of those buckets would be considered did not arise until the court in Minnesota said, I'm not going to consider any of that. That's not a factor here in Minnesota.
Where in the record did the judge you said that a few times in your briefs. Where in the record does the judge in Illinois say, I'm not, or in Minnesota say, I'm not going to consider that? I understand your complaint that you didn't get as much common benefit time that you think you should have been allotted, but is it, can you point to us in the record? And I'm not trying to test you, the record's voluminous, but I never, I mean, I don't know what, where to go put my finger on that.
So
I'm not even going to consider it.
Sure. I think you raise a fair point, Judge. My use of the word consider may be, it may not be the appropriate, the proper word. What I'm saying is ultimately, and there is no dispute about this, the judge did not award that time. So whether she considered it and rejected it, which I think is where you're going and is probably a fair statement of the record, the fact of the matter still remains. There's a third bucket of time in Illinois that we weren't compensated for. So as it relates to the waiver argument, when we're told by the district court in the motion to reconsider or in the motion for clarification, rather, you will be compensated for work, quote, wherever performed, that third bucket was never compensated. So our harm, our injury, our obligation to object to that is triggered once the district court in Minnesota refuses to follow the directive of Judge Lundstrom. So that's what our argument is. It's not a waiver because of the fact that it, the harm did not arise until the court in Minnesota refused to award time for that bucket of time that was awarded in Illinois.
And I think your harm, oh, go ahead, Judge.
But I'm following up on your point, I think, in a, Judge Bacharach, in a different way. I mean, yes, this the language about consider or not consider is not just a matter of semantics, because if the issue is that the court considered but decided not to award as it relates to that bucket, that doesn't mean that you weren't given the, it just means that these different courts chose to value those hours differently. And that doesn't mean that there wasn't attention paid to evaluation analysis of, it's just the court decided not to treat it in the same way. And so why wouldn't Judge Lundstrom's statement still hold that that's exactly what they did? You just don't end up with the same result.
Because we were not compensated where the work was performed. In other words, if one court is saying, I'm going to compensate you for this broader notion of common benefit, and the other court decides, I'm not going to pay you for that, or you're not going to get paid for that, that's not a waiver, because that harm doesn't arise until the court fails to follow Judge Lundstrom's edict that you must consider wherever the work
is. Well, that's the point I'm making. The word consider comes into play again, and what consider means, if the court considers and then decides not to allocate it, as opposed to saying categorically, this is not on the table. But let me just ask another point, for which is, are you saying that the disparity between what went on in Illinois and what went on in Minnesota, is that based upon the special master's allocation or of this broader common benefit time? Or are you talking about what the Illinois district judge did? Because they didn't do the same thing.
Well, that's correct. What we're talking about is that had we, well, 2 points, if I may, Your Honor. Number one, with respect to your immediate question, what we're talking about is the notion that in Illinois, had we been in that pool, we would have received compensation for that time, and the brief spells out what we think the extent of the harm is. Second, and if I just, 10 seconds on this, the direct quote from Judge Lundstrom says, she, the special master, intended her recommendation that each firm would be compensated in the pool for all its common benefit work wherever performed. Our argument relates to the term would be compensated. We were not compensated for that broader common benefit time, which we would have been compensated for had we been in Illinois.
And you're saying, but the Illinois district judge would have compensated you for that time.
Oh, absolutely. Now, while in fairness, the judge, the second judge, I forget her name, I apologize, reduced the emphasis of broader common benefit time than Judge Herndon gave. She clearly awarded time and compensated people for this notion of broader common benefit time. And because Judge Lundstrom's order from the bench, or his colloquy, says that each firm would be compensated from its pool for all common benefit work wherever performed, that is the genesis of the harm, because we weren't compensated for that time.
All right. Thank you,
counsel. Mr. Wilders?
Yep. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Let me start to try to clear up because I think this goes really critically to the waiver argument, which is how this happened. And this is what happened. Special Master Reisman issued a report and recommendation breaking firms up by jurisdiction. And Johnson Becker was assigned to Minnesota. Johnson Becker filed an objection, or what they later called the motion for clarification, saying, well, we performed work in Illinois. And the judge said, I'm gonna say that wherever the work was performed, the judge who is evaluating this will be entitled to consider that work in terms of awarding fees. And they, on the record, they were happy with that conclusion. That's not disputed. Then later, because the Minnesota and the Kansas leadership, when they had submitted their applications to the court, they both had firms, or four or five firms, that performed work in both jurisdictions at the direction of leadership. And because of that, they had asked for their particular allocations based on the work that was performed there. And so they went to the judge, they went back to Judge Lundstrom. We filed a stipulation and request for stipulation saying, Judge, we all think, and we're the ones most affected, we think we should be able to pay these firms from both pools. And the judge said, I agree, that's fine. He signed the stipulation. That was the point where if Johnson Becker wanted to be treated that way, they could have said, hey, well, we're renewing our motion now, and we want to be treated differently. We're filing a motion for reconsideration. We want to be treated in both pools. They didn't do that. They continued to stick to the Minnesota pool. And so they had the opportunity to be treated like the five firms that were awarded from both pools, and they chose not to. They're not unique in this regard. There are other firms that were awarded fees from a single jurisdiction, but perform work in both. The Toops Kaufman plaintiffs group that we heard from earlier today, they filed cases in Illinois and they filed cases in Kansas. They were only awarded fees from Kansas. And the Hinniger Garrison Davis firm was only awarded fees from Kansas. They did a small amount of work also on behalf of the Kansas leadership, and they got from one pool. So this was something that was happening, and the courts were trying to figure out who was best positioned to evaluate this work. If Johnson Becker had wanted to be evaluated in both pools, it had an obligation to ask for that before the court recommended a fee to that firm.
Okay, so what's your timeline then? What is the point in which Johnson Becker, in your view, needed to renew their objection? I mean, specifically, what point are you talking about?
So as Judge Lundstrom found when he rejected their objection to Judge Miller's report, they had an obligation under Kansas local rules to file a motion for reconsideration within 14 days of the December 31st, 2018 order. And Judge Lundstrom specifically found waiver. And I would point out that in their opening brief, the Johnson Becker appellants don't even address waiver.
Well, was the 31st order, was that the one that included the compensated language that Johnson and Becker is making much of?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, the suggestion is that 31st order didn't really tell them what they needed to know in terms of what was going to happen later, right?
So let me turn to that then. So that's their merits argument. And their merits argument is that apparently Judge Miller didn't follow Judge Lundstrom's order in that regard. And I disagree with that. I think this is another procedural tangle, but nothing's quite simple in this case. I want to back up. When Johnson Becker filed for fees from Judge Miller, or when they objected to the report and recommendation of the Minnesota leadership that was submitted to Judge Miller, they argued, hey, we were going to be awarded more fees from Minnesota based on Judge Stack's report and recommendation. He was the special master in Minnesota. He hadn't even served his report yet, but they had gotten a copy and they thought they would do better off there. That was the first time they said, Minnesota leadership isn't treating us fairly. Subsequently, Judge Stack issued his report and that went into the record. And what Judge Miller said was, I'm not convinced you would have done better under Judge Stack's methodology. So she did not find that this work was compensable. She found this work wasn't compensable in Minnesota or Illinois. And that was the basis for her ruling and rejecting their objection. Then after Judge Lundstrom rejected their objections to Judge Miller, Judge Stack's methodology got thrown out the window by Judge Rosenstein. because she found that wasn't consistent with Judge Lungstrom's with the December 31st characterization by Judge Lungstrom and the other two judges of what constituted common benefit work. She found that Judge Stack had relied on things that Johnson Becker is saying is expanded common benefit work that shouldn't have been. And that's why Judge Rosenstengel adopted a different methodology. And I think if you look at Judge Rosenstengel's opinion, it's not clear. And I would say it's the opposite of clear that she would have awarded more fees to Johnson Becker based on the work that they're now claiming that wasn't given sufficient weight in Minnesota. Because what Judge Rosenstengel said was the same thing that Judge Lungstrom and Judge Miller said, which is, I'm giving more weight to work that substantively advanced the litigation. And Johnson Becker got paid for the 400 hours of work in Illinois in Minnesota from the Minnesota pool. They got paid for that from Judge Miller. And the rest of the work was stuff that did not advance the litigation. So I don't think that they have established, they certainly haven't argued, they haven't even described what that work was, why it would have been compensated in Illinois. So I don't, first of all, I don't think it's arbitrary that they were assigned to Minnesota because they did perform work there. And Judge Miller was able to evaluate whether that work advanced the litigation. And second of all, even if it was arbitrary, they haven't shown that they would have been entitled to more fees from the Illinois judge under the methodology that was actually adopted, which was not the one that was in play whenever they made their objection to Judge Miller. Judge Rosenstengel, narrowed common benefit work from what Judge Stack had recommended. And she had already found that even under Judge Stack's methodology, she wasn't persuaded they would have gotten greater fees. So unless the court has other questions, I'm happy to surrender the rest of my time. Appreciate the court's attention to this appeal, and we ask for full affirmance.
Thank you, Mr. Wilder.
If it's okay.
Of course, always.
Judge, I was about to point you to Judge, Mr. Wilder. Mr. Wilder's, on your waiver argument, the failure to file a motion for reconsideration, typically I thought that our case law, and tell me if I'm wrong, says that, once a judge issues an order, an order. You don't have to ask for reconsideration. Is there a case law that you're familiar with that would recognize a forfeiture or a failure to preserve based on a failure to file, to seek reconsideration?
Well, let me back up. They forfeited the argument at the hearing on the special master's recommendation when they characterized it as a motion for clarification. And they said, we just want to be sure that Judge Miller will be permitted to consider our Illinois work. And Judge Lungstrom made clear that that was the intention. So they had withdrawn effectively their objection to being placed into Minnesota at that time. They did not, over the course of the next 14 days, seek reconsideration. At the same time, for example, when the Kansas and Minnesota CLC said, we've got some firms that we think should be compensated from both pools. And so my point was, if they didn't understand that that was a possibility from the date the December 31st order was entered, they had 14 days to go back to the court having withdrawn their objection and seek reconsideration. They didn't. And so
I think what the argument is that we still were operating under the assurance that when the allocation was actually made in Minnesota, we would be treated fairly in the sense that all of our common benefit work, no matter where performed, would be compensated. And their position is that is not what happened. And therefore, they had a fresh objection after that allocation was made.
So, but the other issue was initially there was not going to be any opportunity to object from what Judge Miller was going to issue for a fee award. So there wouldn't have been a second opportunity to object to that. And once the court decided that he would enter a final allocation order from each jurisdiction, he said specifically, I will only consider structural or procedural objections. I'm not going to consider whether Judge Miller or Judge Rosenstengel did it correctly in terms of weighting the value. I'm not going to get into a position where every piece of work that they decided was not common benefit work, I'm going to review. And ultimately, I mean, if you look at the opening brief of the appellants here, they don't make an argument that the work that they performed that Judge Miller rejected was actually what they call expanded common benefit work. I mean, they don't really appeal her finding on that front. So I would say that in that point, they've waived the argument on appeal because they haven't established that she made any error, aside from the fact that, you know, whether they waived it below or not.
All right. Mr. Becker, to make sure that you walk away thinking you've been treated fairly, we're gonna give 1 minute here, and then we're going to wrap this show up.
thank you, Judge Holmes. Just a couple of quick points. Judge Bachrach is correct that there is no obligation to object again or file a motion for reconsideration, and that case law is spelled out in our brief. Second, just to put this in a finer point on the timeline was this. We went to the oral argument before Judge Lungstrom where he said we would be compensated, and I read to you that quote. Following that, then, we went to Minnesota, and the court ultimately, briefs were filed on what the parties thought they should get. The court ultimately ruled, and we objected at that point. There was no obligation to re-object to Judge Miller's findings because her findings were her findings, and in our view, they were inconsistent with what Judge Lungstrom had. So the only obligation we had to that order was the appeal that we've now lodged following our trip back to Judge Lungstrom. I know it's complicated, but as you alluded to earlier, Judge Holmes, the trigger for all of this was Judge Lungstrom's assurance that we would be, quote, compensated for that time. That never happened. And that's why there was never a waiver.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. I think we're at the end of the road on this. Case is submitted, and we will reconvene as a court tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.